Welcome everyone to the last session of the City Seminar this year. Because it's the last session, before I introduce the speaker, I wanted to sort of try to sum up or pull together everything we've heard this year, as much as that's possible. Obviously the theme was mobilizing cities, and we've tried to look at that and interrogate that sort of from a variety of perspectives. And some of those were perhaps global circulations of people, but also of capital. So we had Richard Burroughs talking about the super rich, Roger Burroughs talking about the super rich in London and sort of international movements of capital and people there. We had Caroline Knowles talking about globalization along the back roads, tracing the movement of a flip-flop across the world and sort of this movement of things then also ended up in sort of the hustle economy of Nairobi, which Tatiana Tima talked about when she was talking about the recycling of garbage there in a slum in Nairobi. We had sort of macro questions of urban studies. Andy Merrifield talked about the new urban question. Jenny Robinson talked about theorizing cities. How can we even compare cities on a global scale? But we also talked about political mobilizations and the spatial practices that are involved in that in cities. So we had someone coming from the Shack Dwellers movement in South Africa to talk about mobilizations there in Durban. We talked about cultures of dissent in Lahore, grassroots movements in Istanbul in terms of reactions to urban renewal were one topic, and our last speaker talked about motorcycle taxi drivers in Bangkok and how they were involved in street protests. One of our speakers, Ariel Handel from Tel Aviv, spoke about gated and gating communities, so using sort of the settlements as in the West Bank as an example of gated communities that also fulfill the function of fencing in other communities. And I think that ties in quite well with what Sobia is going to talk about today, because she'll be talking about the sort of securitized enclaves of Karachi and the effects that those have on the everyday circulations within the city, but perhaps also inside, and also posing the question, do those securitized enclaves actually make a city more safe? Sobia is a PhD student in the School of Architecture, Planning, and Landscape at Newcastle University, but she's also a research associate at LSE Cities, where she works in the urban governance strand on urban uncertainty specifically. She's also a visiting research fellow at the Center for Research and Security Studies in Islamabad, and has recently published a paper on her PhD research in South Asian history and culture, as well as in the Harvard Design Magazine together with Steve Graham. I'm really excited to hear your talk, and welcome.
Thank you, Hannah, for having me here and for inviting me. It's a pleasure to speak to all of you about my work. So, like you mentioned, this presentation is draws strong references with my PhD project, but it also draws heavily on the paper that I recently published with Steve, which appeared in the Harvard Design Magazine, issue 37. So I must acknowledge both Steve's and my second supervisor, Martin's, contribution in helping me shaping the thoughts that I'm going to present today. Before I start, I'd just like to share a very personal story about sort of my first experiences of Karachi, which really got me thinking about the city that I was living in and the city I began to study later. I moved to Karachi in 2008 from Islamabad, which is a very, very small city in comparison. It's a very neatly organized, sort of clean, green capital city as compared to the sort of big mega city, bustling with people, bustling with traffic, bustling with sort of energy that Karachi is. And while I've had experiences of living in big cities, especially since I'd been a student in London and I'd stayed on for a year or so, Karachi was an entirely different ballgame altogether. The city was about sort of 20 million people, so literally three times the size of London in population as well as in area. It was also a very insecure city, so while I had heard so many stories about people sharing experiences of muggings or crimes or robberies, I'd never experienced anything on by myself, but I'd always remained petrified about stepping out, about going out, about being in the city. So like anyone else, who now I make fun of, I bunkered down in sort of very secure enclaves. I started living in a very securitized apartment complex. I would only go meet my friends in malls or securitized cinemas or high-end cafes. The gym I used to go to was in this building right here. it just made me feel so perfectly safe that, you know, nothing can touch me, nothing can really happen. And it was just an experience of being very encapsulated in this sort of bubble that not every Karachiite feels. At the same time, you know, I had a very small incident while one of my visits to the gym at this hotel, which I think is a very interesting opening point to start my presentation with. So my story isn't as scary or as terrible as some of the really bad ones that I've heard, which involve sort of murder and killings and sort of, you know, arms and heavy violence. But it's just a story of my wallet being stolen. And this happened while I was in the gym, and, you know, I was having a nice swim, I came back out, and all of a sudden I realized that it's not there. And I was quite sure that I had it with me, and, you know, I had put it safely in my locker. So when I left the gym and I found out that my wallet was missing from my bag, I immediately called the bank to cancel my credit cards. And by that time, I realized that about £3,000 equivalent had been spent, that I hadn't obviously spent. And I could not do anything to get them back because, like any other Karachiite, I hadn't been offered any form of security or insurance from my bank for such a theft. It had to be a premium service that I hadn't opted in, thinking it's not going to happen to me. At the same time, when I tried going to the police and asked their help to engage, you know, sort of in helping me find whoever did this or get my money back, I realized that I really couldn't trust the police because it showed very, very evidently that they just wanted a cut of whatever money, you know, I would retrieve, but also perhaps they're very hesitant knowing that, you know, how can they find whoever did this? When I approached the security at the Sheraton, you know, saying, you guys talk about brilliant security, so do you have any means of finding out who did it? And they just kind of said, our CCTV cameras didn't really cover that area, so we don't know who it is. And, you know, we can just ask the cleaners or the maids, but, you know, I wouldn't put my hopes on it. So very disappointedly, I thought I'd try doing this myself. So my husband and I, we kind of made our rounds and, you know, we started calling the bank, finding out sort of where the transactions had taken place. Turned out we were lucky. It was in a mall that we recognized, in a shop that we recognized. So we rushed to the mall, we rushed to the shop, we spoke to the shopkeeper. It was turned out that it was a lady who had bought very expensive handbags from my card. So, you know, I kind of just warned the person that, you know, that was stolen. Can I have a receipt of the transaction or perhaps even, you know, the forged signature on the receipt so I can, you know, trace the person or find out who they are? But to cut a long story short, I was lucky. I was able to sort of get the money back. My experience wasn't as terrible as it was. But it also helped show quite a few things about Karachi to me. It showed how residents are really left to themselves when it comes to any kind of incident such as this. They have no one to turn to. There's no justice. The police really can't be trusted. Even places like the Sheraton, where, you know, which offer complete and total security, you know, small things like this continue to happen. And it also showed the abject criminalization of the poor. Although whoever had spent the money on the handbags, or you know, who had stolen my card and spent the money on handbags, belonged to a very good family from, you know, a middle-class family, the blame had immediately gone to the cleaners or the maids. So in this presentation, I'll kind of depart from there. I'll start thinking about sort of the notion of the archipelago city, and this notion is something that's out there in literature and that I'll explain further later. So this archipelago city, which is characterized by a fragmented urban landscape made up of various interconnected enclaves. And in doing so, I will focus on the different experiences of urban actors living in the security city and the range of circulations produced by and in spite of processes of enclosure. I will also highlight the relational nature of enclavization and demonstrate how the practices and processes linked to creating and upholding enclaves are productive of various political outcomes. So this picture and the comment above it sort of it introduces one of such enclaves, which is Karachi's Sheraton Hotel, now rebranded as Movenpick Karachi. The Karachi Sheraton Hotel is increasingly fortified off from its immediate environment. Blast walls, checkpoints, surveillance systems, and armies of police and security guards continuously work to try and control how the hotel's lavish internal spaces relate to the more violent outside city. And this trend follows an increasingly popular logic of military securitization in many of the world's cities, even those that are not former war zones. In this hugely popular book, Steve Rehm has referred to this as a phenomena of a new military urbanism. This relates to an increasingly prevalent obsession in most cities with attaining total security. And as a result, passage point architectures are in place. Such architectures, such as those encountered in airports, are generalized to urban landscapes, places like financial centers, residential areas, embassies, or shopping malls all introduce them. Literature on urban enclaves, particularly a large body of literature on gated communities, also refers to this form of new military urbanism. And the deciding factor, in this literature of total security is architecture. So movement is monitored and restricted through various mechanisms, and enclosure is created through configurations of security architecture, like private security guards, walls, gates. They all combine with CCTV technologies or cameras to make the job of keeping out undesirables. The objective is to move, distance residents inside from the city outside, and at the same time allow freedom of movement of safe passage while restricting risky passage. Examples from cities across the world, from Sao Paulo to Johannesburg to Singapore, highlight how such fortified enclaves emerge as material responses to fear and crime and insecurity. So my argument is that such literature on fortified enclaves, it overemphasizes physical structures. I would like to argue that such an uptake, it risks in creating an environmentally deterministic notion of enclave spaces, and it suggests that these constructions work completely or that their effects can be assumed from their appearance. Viewed as such in prominent literature, the city is imagined as an archipelago of enclaves where urban spaces are largely disconnected from other urban spaces. Instead, I argue that it's important to look beyond the already familiar physical architectures of enclave cities per se. Taking a relational view of urbanism, it becomes impossible to view fortified enclaves as isolated or capsular spaces. This is especially so given the complex interconnections between gated communities and the rest of the city. The functioning of such spaces draws constant interaction between the inside and the outside. And paradoxically, this is most evident when one views the practices, the processes, and performances of security. The work of filtering circulation, a concept that Foucault describes as securing movement by filtering good from bad, is extremely difficult in huge, dynamic, and highly mobile megacities. The job of providing security and scrutiny itself requires immense and ongoing labor that connects the inside from the outside. As this picture shows, this involves continuous interaction between a large number of people and technologies. So security gates combined with CCTV cameras and X-ray machines, and all of these are operated by humans and therefore prone to human errors in either the labor that operated, or they may simply fail due to glitches or errors or technical issues. And for me, it's these dynamic relationships between those who perform the work of boundaries and those who live in used enclave spaces that is profoundly important, because it reveals the osmotic nature of enclave borders, and at the same time, it reveals how the transformation of megacity landscapes into uneven patchworks of fortified enclaves work to produce novel experiences and forms of urban political life. My question then is simple. How is the new security city, the apparent archipelago of gated enclaves, lived? And to address this question, I'll take you all back to Karachi. Although I briefly introduced my own experiences of Karachi, I'll just kind of focus very briefly on what the city is really about. So the growing megacity of more than 20 million people is the main port and financial center of Pakistan. And like most cities across the most such megacities across the world, it's a city of migrants. Mm-hmm. It attracts people from all over Pakistan and beyond who flock towards it in search of livelihoods or relief from disaster and insecurity. The city is also highly polarized and socio-spatially divided. Almost half the residents live in Kachi Abadis, which essentially mean informal settlements, or there are a range of settlements which are low income. Some of them regularized, some of them aren't, but they have all been informally planned. And these sort of Kachi Abadis supply essential low-cost labor to the service to serve the global city. And while Karachi's always had a troubled past, one heavy with political conflict and gang violence, the city has more recently become a lightning rod through which two programs of organized violence pass and operate. On one hand, it's a pivotal logistical hub and a vital transit route for U.S. and coalition forces fighting in Afghanistan. You know, as this picture shows, the route through Pakistan, though highly susceptible to disruption by riots or by conflict or by terrorist activities, it works out best in terms of time and cost than any other route that the U.S. has thought of. And on the other hand, Taliban groups fighting the U.S.-led coalition forces have crossed into Karachi and have swelled the ranks of the city's existing criminal mafia groups. In some cases, they have also created their own syndicates to generate revenue for the terrorist activities. So Karachi City, like as this map shows, it's got different pockets of newly radicalizing spaces, which are appropriated by the Taliban, who use the city both as a source of revenue generation for their funds, but also as a place to disrupt national politics. So the resulting insecuritization of life in Karachi operates at the expense of ordinary citizens who feel deeply vulnerable to violence in their everyday lives. Personal and reported experiences of violence suggest that Karachiites live amongst multiple fears. They're subjected to frequent terrorist attacks, riots, targeted killings, while they also fear muggings, kidnappings, and burglaries. The environment of fear is accentuated by local and foreign media, which has an obsessive focus on insecurity in Karachi. With a murder rate of approximately 13.49 per 100,000 in 2012, although Karachi is considerably less violent than Detroit, Johannesburg, or Sao Paulo, it is still reported as one of the most dangerous megacities of the world. In such a situation, Karachiites feel especially vulnerable. Failures in enforcing law and order have destroyed the public's confidence in both municipal and national security governance. As a result, an ever-widening process of enclave formation is apparent across the city. Emergent forms of private security governance and securitization involve a mishmash of different forms of architectures. Traditionally, the streets are openly laid out, so there's not much of a concept of gated communities that might exist in other cities like Sao Paulo. But for most residents, enclosure is a tactic that they employ very effectively. So they might use a range of materials like empty shipping containers or booms, barriers, or sort of plant infrastructures or concrete blocks in various ways to disrupt the flow of movement, just to kind of slow people down or slow their speed down so they can kind of place guards at borders to monitor who's coming through and who isn't. And such improvised architectures are not only prevalent in the more affluent parts of the cities, but they're also used in many informal settlements. So in poor Kachi Abadis, emerging enclaves allow residents to survive. It's important in keeping out troublemakers, says Imam, pointing to gates made of scrap and wood and iron in the Balti Muhalla of Sultanabad, while at the same time, in more affluent areas, they allow people a sense of freedom. Once I enter the gates, I feel safe, said Molly, a resident of Askari 3, a gated community in the heart of Karachi. Inside, life continues as normal. It's like an island of order in a city of disorder. However, despite the walls, setbacks, razor wires, gates, fences, and omnipotent security, enclaves remain deeply connected to the wider city and to the world beyond. Evidence of security breaches, and there are many, suggests that it's impossible to achieve total security. The same gated community that Molly spoke of in 2011 was violently invaded, I could say, or you know, a violent incident took place there in February 2012. And this was when a family of five were found murdered in their house. And it turned out that it was someone, you know, living within the settlement, an old driver of theirs who'd gone in and killed the whole family. So incidents such as these, I mean, they continuously occur. and efforts to filter these inside-outside relationships then sometimes create paradoxes of insecurity. And this is something that I'm going to start focusing on very soon. So this is just an idea about Karachi, and this is a map of the different spaces that I'm going to speak of. The red sort of circle surrounding outside is very sort of broadly worked circle that signifies the security red zone. So it's a part of Karachi that's highly securitized because of the important buildings that it houses. It's close to the U.S. Consulate, the Financial Center, the Karachi Stock Exchange, very close to the Karachi Port. The CID building here, which is a Criminal Investigation Department building, is the building from which all investigations into terrorist activities in Karachi take place. Then you've got the Karachi Sheraton Hotel, which I introduced earlier. Paradoxically, this space is also the most targeted when it comes to terrorist bomb attacks in Karachi. So the Sheraton has had its share of a bomb attack. The CID building has had one. Marriott Hotel and the Japanese Consulate have had one. So it's also so paradoxically a place of heightened security, but also heightened insecurity. I'll also speak about Clifton Block 7, which is a residential neighborhood to the south of this sort of security red zone, and Sultanabad, which is a Kachiabadi in the heart of the security red zone. And I'll speak, of this these two in relation to Sheraton and try to explain how they all come together. So the Karachi Sheraton system of defense includes hard boundaries and state-of-the-art surveillance and security technologies. Security checks start well before anyone enters the hotel. Cars line up in a separate lane leading to the hotel's gate. And once guards establish where you're going to, the second and third tier checks kick in. And these involve screening the vehicles for explosives or suspicious objects. An apparatus of armed guards, screening devices, sniffer dogs, angled mirrors, and cameras embedded in the road combine to check the car's occupants, its chassis, its boot, as well as its hood for suspicious contents. If these steps are cleared without piquing suspicions, the vehicle is granted entry. Pedestrians, too, face airport-style security checks. They're made to walk through a scanner gate while placing their bags and metal items in a basket that goes through an X-ray device. Guards stationed in these posts are tasked to identify suspicious people or items. Interviews with people going through the checks show that the very process of ensuring security inside the hotel worked in dramatic ways to heighten a sense of insecurity outside. This is because the peripheral security architecture of enclaves are often the very targets of a suicide bomb attack. In May 2002, for instance, a suicide car bomb targeting French naval engineers staying at the Sheraton exploded outside the hotel's gates. The violent attack killed 14 people, 11 of whom were foreigners. If a terrorist blast occurs, remarks Gulmina, a regular guest at the hotel, it will most likely happen when I'm going through the security checks, stuck between the cars in front and behind me. Similarly, the security at the Sheraton also makes evident the sheer monotony of working the labor of producing security. And it also highlights how this labor works to merely produce a theoretical symbol of the distance of outside and inside. Walking through the pedestrian check, it becomes obvious how perfunctory the whole process is. The very guard looks into the bag half-heartedly while chatting to his colleague who's just looking at the monitor through which the X-ray machine screens bags. One of these guards, Aslam, who we will encounter later, voices our suspicions. My presence here shows how strict Sheraton security is, he says. Even if I don't fully check people's bags, I take a cursory look anyway. I really have no way of stopping a blast. That's all up to Allah. I'm likely to be the first victim, the unnamed person who dies with the big names. Quite melodramatic, but Aslan's quite right. And he draws attention to the performative nature of security checks and the inevitability of permeable connections that link enclaves to the city and the world beyond. The impossibility of perfect control and total panopticate transparency means that despite careful measures, security breaches often occur. This is especially so when the terrorist body becomes the explosive ordnance at the very moment when scrutiny takes place, as is often the case in a suicide bombing. In a video released in November 2010, after a particularly deadly attack on a fortress CID building right here, A posthumous claim by a terrorist was made known to the public. I'm fit and healthy and can fight anywhere, he said, but I've offered myself for the suicide attack only to defeat the enemy's technology. The enemy has technology that can only be defeated by the suicide attack. Securitization in a city terrorized by suicide bombing is thus contradictory. The very technologies that promise security paradoxically also generate insecurities. And in the case of suicide attacks, the public is often collateral damage in a war on enclaves. Security architectures, processes, and technologies also inevitably generate insecurities and security gaps within themselves. The guards employed to buttress security within enclaves are often a cause for concern for many on the inside who strive for total protection. Such perceived problems come to light, especially in upscale residential neighborhoods like Clifton Block 7. Clifton Block 7 is a recently enclosed neighborhood, planned as as an open plan neighborhood with sort of broad streets and big houses. It houses the city's elite. More recently, however, the residents have organized themselves collectively to practice enclosure. And they've placed booms at all entry and exit points, and they've placed private security guards at each of these booms to monitor whoever is going in or going out. CCTV cameras are also placed to supplement security guards' gaze. At the same time, 24-hour motorcycle patrols also take place, just to make sure that everything's in order and sort of no suspicious activities taking place at any time. In paradoxical ways reminiscent of some of the dystopian fiction of J.D. Ballard, these watchful eyes make some Block 7 residents uneasy. I don't like the idea of the guards knowing my daily routine, admits Samina. I feel more insecure knowing that they are aware of my movements. Indeed, the security system often turns in on itself in various ways. While showing me their control room, Azim, a senior member of the Block 7 Resident Association, proudly stated, I tell the guard that these CCTV cameras not only watch criminals, but also watch them. So we'll know immediately if they've been lax in their jobs. This paradox of insecurity is one aspect of enclavization that highlights the deeply political nature of these spaces. Service workers such as maids, drivers, gardeners, and guards, residents of the deeply insecure city beyond, who must continuously be relied on to provide services and to allow functioning of these enclaves, are never fully trusted. The manager for security at the Sheraton, as well as the president of the Block 7 Association, repeatedly told me that their biggest threat comes from their laborers. They may talk about our security details at the local tea shop in their Kachiabadi. What then? They live amongst criminals, said Azim. Other quotes such as, having a live-in maid is like having a thief sleep on your porch. Or 99% of the times, these guards are in cahoots with the robbers, further suggest the paradoxical interactions between workers and enclave residents. Given the mistrust of domestic workers and private security guards, police and security officials recommend potential employers to conduct strict background checks. The suggested procedure is to verify the applicant's national identity card number against the personal details shared. The NIC card basically can be checked by sending an SMS to the government database on that registers identities, just to corroborate whether all facts are right. At the same time, copies of the NIC card are also encouraged to be given to the police, so the police can conduct strict security checks on applicants, but at the same time, the police can also have a record on where to trace whoever you've employed in case they become suspects in any kind of case. So in such a way, despite being users of enclave spaces, workers are constantly viewed with suspicion. This is the central contradiction of the enclave megacity. The vast labor of work essential for producing and sustaining elite enclaves falls to an army of low-paid and profoundly insecure workers who inhabit the increasingly demonized city beyond. Such complex governance and policing arrangements further marginalize poor urban service workers. They formalize mistrust. But how do they fare as political subjects and residents within the insecure megacity? In search for protection, they too are pushed into their own much more peripheral and less well-resourced enclaves. In the city's sprawling Kachiabadis, police and security lead frequent and violent incursions against the urban poor. Such raids treat Kachiabadi residents as sources of insecurity in the city, where ironically, many of them work all week performing security. Sultanabad, our final case study, is one such enclave. It's a dense, multi-ethnic, low-income settlement located well within the security wells, red zone. It neighbors the Fort Restorers Consulate and is within a 1 mile radius of both the Sheraton Hotel, the recently bombed CID building, and as well as the Governor's House and Law Courts, as well as 5th and Block 7. After a suicide bomb in the CID building in 2011, the police picked up more than 200 residents in a theatrical exercise of force. Since then, the place has earned a reputation as a dangerous criminal hub, making life difficult for job seekers, especially domestic, household, and security staff. Its narrow labyrinth city, streets and alleys already deter visitors from outside, while its reputation as a violent and dangerous place further provides disincentive for ordinary Karachiites to venture within. Although I found moving in Sultanabad relatively easy and safe, it was mainly because I was going through someone local to the area who was a respected community leader. Nevertheless, I soon learned that there were some mohallas, or neighborhood clusters, which were strictly out of bounds from even for local residents. As you can see from pictures, you know, the geography of the settlement itself makes entries a bit difficult, but also the graffiti on the walls, it does show sort of violent appropriations of space as well as expressions of intent. Residents of some such mohallas have been involved in crimes ranging from robberies, illegal drug trafficking, and terrorist activities. Despite the fact that criminality is localized within the mohallas, those from other parts of Sultanabad are equally subjected to sporadic military operations by the police and paramilitary force attempting to restore order in Karachi. Although viewed by security forces as a space that generates insecurity to the wider city, Sultanabad's residents argue that they themselves are victims of a fast militarizing Karachi. One resident, Aslam, who we met earlier at the Sheraton, who works as a guard there, points to his smart security guard uniform and wonders, "What's the point of this? I can't seem to keep myself and my family secure. The other night, someone crept up into our apartment through the window and made away with my valuables." Similarly, Kausar, a cleaning lady who works at a residence in Clifton Block 7, speaks of her ordeal. "Between the police and the forthcoming elections, I have had enough," she complains. "Every few days, the police come in. I don't know who or what they're looking for. And then all these political party workers come in asking for votes, sweet-talking and threatening in the same breath." A heightened sense of everyday insecurity, cases of police brutality and injustice, and a sense of abandonment from the state are common themes in interviews with local residents in Sultanabad. For Sultanabad's inhabitants, the process of being pushed out of the urban mainstream turned into a process of establishing alternative ways of living, managing, and governing everyday life amidst insecurity. Seizing control of their lives by engaging with the competitive vote politics of Karachi, residents have organized themselves to vote collectively. They now negotiate patronage from political parties that can offer personal security. In rejecting the biased police, residents have also established community arrangements for policing and dispensing justice. Such independence from the police and justice system and orientation towards the city's violent vote politics have further intensified Sultanabad's reputation as a violent no-go area for anybody else in Karachi. Karachi's case is obviously distinct because it's so deeply bound up with the transnational violence of the war on terror and its derivatives. However, deconstructing urban life through the lens of security enclaves in Karachi is illuminating for many other cities. The inside-outside relationships of enclaves reveal how the new military urbanism produces political subjectivities that heighten marginality and vulnerability for the urban poor. As the case of Sultanabad reveals, this vulnerability is managed by marginalized urban residents by creating their own version of enclaves, which are often linked to and reinforce the criminal, mafia, or terrorist networks that the rest of the city braces itself against. Above all, enclaves constitute new styles of urban life and urban politics as an ensemble. To really appreciate life in the new security city, I'd like to argue that attention must fall beyond checkpost architectures per se. We must instead piece together how archipelagos of different sorts of enclaves relate together to recognize broader geographies on inequality, labor, governance, patronage, and not to be forgotten, reputation. Thank you. Thank you.